Well, as we speak, and as you know, the leaders of the world's largest economies are meeting in London, trying to make their voices heard over the protesters outside and, in fact, over each other. They're trying to agree on a strategy to deal with the worsening economic crisis. The expectation seems to be that the G20 communique will tend to mask the major differences in opinion between, well, the US, the UK, the European Union on the efficacy of using massive stimulus packages to prop up receding economies. And the G20 leaders will be exercised by another consequence of the economic crisis, which is the tendency to balk at continuing free trade reforms in favour of a return to protectionist policies. Today, the New York Times reported there are signs that the world's biggest experiment in free trade, the single European market, is cracking under pressure from protectionist demands. Now, the Union has a hell of a lot on its plate, from dealing with the competing demands and expectations of its members in terms of trade to its relationships with the key powers on a geopolitical map that is undergoing a rapid rewrite. Well, our next guest is right in the middle of these tensions, except for the couple of weeks he's here in Australia. I presume that Fraser Cameron came here seeking political asylum. He's a former British diplomat. He served for long periods at both the UN and in Germany, and he's now director of the EU-Russia Centre and a senior advisor at the European Policy Centre in Brussels. Fraser Cameron is here. Well, he's here, as I said, for political asylum, but also for a series of public lectures on the future of the Union and its relationships with China, the US, and, of course, his particular interest, Russia. Fraser is hiding in our Brisbane studio. Welcome to our little wireless program.
Good evening.
How serious are the differences at G20?
I think they've been overblown by the media, as usual, in the run-up to the summit. They need a story, and there's always talk of a split. And the reality is that, in the end, there is a communique agreed by all, and Sarkozy stays, and Obama smiles, and they will all go away, and the real work will start, because nobody can expect any single summit to produce the answers. But the important thing is they agree a set of principles, and you already mentioned one, and that's the fight against protectionism. And it's actually far more dangerous, I think, in the United States than in Europe. And it's really rather alarming that Obama last week wrote an op-ed in many newspapers and didn't even mention the Doha trade round. So I think we really have to be very careful, because the WTO thinks that world trade is going to contract by about 9% this year, and that's very damaging for Europe and for Australia.
Of course, we're all circling the wagons. This idea of be a good Australian, buy Australian is echoed in almost every nation state, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's false economy. We've all benefited hugely from free trade, and inevitably there will be some protectionist tendencies, but we certainly want to avoid a rerun of the 1930s, because we all know where that led to.
I'm suddenly remembering Mr. Rumsfeld, I do so reluctantly, but he comes to mind because of his new Europe, old Europe argument. So let's look at some of the new Europe. Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, absolutely dependent on their exports. The impact of any protectionism would be devastating, would it not?
Sure, but there's substantial differences between these countries, so it's wrong to think that East Europe is in some kind of crisis. The Czech Republic and Poland are doing quite well. The problem countries at the moment are Latvia and Hungary and Ukraine, which is outside the European Union. So we can't lump them all in the same boat.
Well, Latvia and Hungary, of course, are quite small economies.
Mm. But the European Union can cope with that. I mean, trying to cope with a major country like Ukraine would be extremely difficult. And I think the European Union would also look to Russia to help if things got really bad in Ukraine.
Well, I've got to tell you, there hasn't been much discussion in Australia about the Ukrainian crisis. How bad is it?
Very bad. I mean, unemployment's rising to 15%. It's compounded by a lack of political agreement. The people who won in the Orange Revolution a few years ago have fallen out with each other. So there's a three-way split at the political, senior political level. And sometimes the president says he'll call new elections, then he won't. And sometimes he gets on well with the prime minister and then he falls out with her. So it's a real mess in Ukraine, and there's no real national unity on pursuing the necessary reforms if they want to get closer to the European Union. And, of course, there's no unity also on another question, membership of NATO.
Now, Fraser, we've just heard that the demonstrations in Reykjavik have ebbed away, but they're pretty big in Kiev, aren't they not?
In Kiev?
Yeah.
Yeah, they are, but that's very understandable given the dramatic drop in the economic growth in Ukraine in very recent times. They had been led to believe that they were on the upward trend and things were going well, and then suddenly they've been hit by the crisis more than most other countries.
I was reading a recent paper of yours, and I quote, the European Neighbourhood Policy, ENP, is the flagship policy of the European Union, designed to promote a zone of friends around its borders through increased prosperity, stability and security. How's the policy holding up?
Well, it's too early to tell. I mean, it's a long-term policy. The idea is to encourage these countries to make the reforms that would prepare them for membership. This is what was done very successfully with the countries closer to the EU, like Poland, Czech Republic, who are now members of the European Union. And naturally, some of these countries, led by Poland, are very keen that Ukraine also joins the European Union. But there are strict criteria to be met.
And well, these include good economic policy, good governance,
absolutely,
and respect for human rights.
Yeah, all these things. And it's, in essence, a complete transformation of your society if you want to join the European Union, because the European Union goes and looks at the state of your prisons, the water you drink, the cars you drive. It's a very intrusive operation.
Now, one of your recommendations is for a pan-European free trade area stretching from Morocco to Vladivostok.
Yeah, that's the logic of, firstly, Russia joining the WTO, and I think that's on the cards within perhaps the next year. And then one moves gradually to liberalise the remaining parts of the market. There's still some restrictions, for example, that the EU imposes on agricultural goods, but Australians will not be surprised to hear that. But the idea of a free trade area from Morocco to Vladivostok is one that is perfectly feasible, because the tariffs on the European Union are only about 6%. So we're not talking about a huge drop to move towards a free trade area.
There was a time, I think, when Australians felt a bit insulted by the EU. We felt excluded clearly from it. But I think most of us hope, have always hoped, that it's going to be an immense success, a great triumph, if for no other reason that it gives us a power block other than, well, I'm talking history now, and so the Bush administration and Russia.
Well, it has been remarkably successful if you just look at what it's achieved in the past 50 years and compare it to any other period in European history. You'll see how successful it is, and it's becoming an ever more important global actor. Without the European Union, there would be no Kyoto Agreement, there would be no International Criminal Court, and it's a strong supporter of the UN, multilateralism, and of course it's the biggest provider of development assistance, technical assistance in the world. So it's gradually...
And you can go back to, let's go back to the Ukraine, because you can claim that as one of your success stories. I'm talking about the resolution of the Orange Revolution in 2004.
Well, that's not finished yet. I mean, I think you need to consolidate democracy through a series of elections, not one event. And I think Ukraine has found it quite difficult to move beyond the surface democracy. Elections on their own are not sufficient to establish democracy. You need a vibrant civil society. You need a strong, independent judicial system, free media, etc., etc. And there's still gaps there in terms of what Ukraine has to do. And, of course, there's huge gaps in terms of what Russia has to do in these areas.
Now, I'm glad you've raised Russia. We'll now look at that. This is LNL on Radio National, abc.net.au/RN. My guest is Fraser Cameron, former British diplomat, now director of the EU-Russia Centre and a senior advisor at the European Policy Centre in Brussels. Tell us about the EU-Russian Centre.
We have three main aims. One, to provide a platform for dialogue between the EU and Russia, because there's a great deal of misunderstanding, misperceptions in that relationship. Secondly, to try and encourage the EU member states to speak with one voice towards Russia, which is not an easy task. And thirdly, to emphasize the importance of the rule of law in the relationship, because this is something that Medvedev has put at the top of his agenda. He talks about legal nihilism, and he has said that Russia needs the rule of law to develop. And so in all these areas, we actually support him.
At a recent conference at your centre, a senior Russian speaker, Nadia Arbatova, said she believed that it's a very troubled partnership. The lack of trust between the strategic partners meant that the energy was not a sufficient imperative for cooperation.
Well, I think we have to be rather more self-confident in dealing with Russia. Some of our politicians seem to think that Russia is still this great superpower. In fact, it's quite a weak state in many areas. Our economy is 12 times bigger than that of Russia. We spend 6 times more on defense than Russia. Gazprom gets 70% of its profits from sales to the EU. So this gives us quite a lot of leverage. We have to recognize how to use it, and that is showing unity by the member states, because the bottom line for everyone is you're liable to get a much better deal negotiating as the European Union than trying to do anything as an individual member state.
Russia was questioning the existence of a joint EU voice.
Of course, it has every right, as has the United States or China, to play divide and rule. It's really up to the European Union to get its act together, whether it's negotiating with Beijing, Washington or Moscow. And that, so far, we have found rather difficult to do.
What do you say to the Russians when they equate EU with NATO?
Well, there is an overlap in membership, but the EU is not a military alliance. The EU is a unique political system that has helped spread prosperity, stability throughout the European continent. The European Union is Russia's biggest trading partner, taking 65% of Russian exports. The EU is the largest investor in Russia. And the EU is the favoured destination of most Russians, whether they're oligarchs buying football clubs or businessmen on holiday or tourists coming to visit Paris, Italy, London.
Fraser, I want to know your view, rather than the EU's as such, your view on the way Putin has rolled back democracy at a local and regional level. How do you feel about the way Russia is developing?
Well, it's going in the wrong direction. I mean, during the Yeltsin era, Russia was freer than at any time in its history. But Putin has attempted to rewrite history and say that it was purely chaos under Yeltsin. Now, there were certainly difficulties. That was inevitable after the collapse of communism. But the restrictions on the press, and there's really no free press left in Russia, the murder of journalists like Anna Politkovskaya and human rights lawyers, and the restrictions on civil society are clearly steps in the wrong direction. And in my view, there are absolutely no need for this, because Putin, partly because he gets so much exposure on the media, is very popular in Russia. And he could easily win elections without doing what he's doing.
Now, OK, one accepts that problems with bureaucracy, corruption, state capitalism, petro-state elements is the sign of an ailing society. Is it ailing to the point of failing?
It's getting that way. As Igor Gaida, the former prime minister, said to me quite recently, it's easy being president when the oil price is $140 a barrel. You can play it being Santa Claus every week. When it's $40 a barrel, it's rather different. And the fact is, Putin was firstly a very lucky man during his period in office, But secondly, he failed to diversify the economy, something he recognised and said he would do. And I think history will judge him rather harshly here because he's not used the windfall that Russia gained to renew the infrastructure, including in the energy sector, to modernise education, the health service, etc., etc.
I'm glad you're on because I can now put a question to you that I've been unable to put to anyone. Given the current state of economic play around the world, is there a revised feeling about Marx in what was the Soviet?
Not at all. I mean, Russia, a bit like China, is Adam Smith on speed. There is no Marxism at all. This Communist Party still exists, but it's a rump organisation. There's a few old-age pensioners who sort of hark back nostalgically to the Soviet days when everything was well-ordered.
OK, but if they're not going to pop him back on his pedestal, could the collapse of markets in the West lead to a resurgent belief in command economic policies, or is that completely out of the question?
No, it's out of the question. I mean, the Russians, like other countries, have taken a chunk of strategic industries partly under state control, including in the energy sector and some other sectors. But this has been mirrored in France and now in the United States.
Sorry, forgive me. Obama has offered to press the reset button on U.S.-Russian relations. What might that mean?
Well, he wrote a friendly letter to Medvedev, and he met him yesterday in London. I think that meeting went well. They agreed to start talks on nuclear arms reduction, and I think this is a ripe hanging fruit that both sides can make progress on fairly quickly. Obama has also hinted at a deal whereby if Russia helps on persuading Iran to give up its nuclear program, then America would drop the missiles planned for Poland and the Czech Republic and would go slow on NATO enlargement. So there's quite a lot to play for here.
And I'm very glad you gave us some of your time. Fraser Cameron, former British diplomat, now director of the EU-Russia Centre and a senior advisor at the European Policy Centre in Brussels. He's here for a series of public lectures on the future of the Union and its relationships with China, the US and, yes, Russia. He's already spoken in Melbourne and Brisbane. You can catch him in Sydney next week at Macquarie University Art Gallery, a lovely little place, on Monday evening at 6:30 p.m. And on Tuesday, he'll do it again at the Australian Institute of International Affairs. And their address is 124 Kent Street, Sydney, at 6 p.m. Thanks, Fraser. This is LNL on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn.